Hi, my name is Nigel Fellows-Freeman and I am the host of Building Tomorrow's Insurer and the founder and CEO of Canopy. I'm going to get you to imagine a world. Imagine a world where we've got some satellite imagery, drone data, Internet of Things, all merged into a single platform. And that's a platform where governments, defense, insurance, any sector you can think of can kind of access an enormous wealth of geospatial data. And you would think that that's maybe in the future, but the reality is that world exists today. And I am very, very excited that we've got the founder of that business here today. We've got Rachel Olney, who's the founder and CEO of GeoSight. She has an incredible history, and we'll dive a little bit into it, going from manufacturing into geospatial data is an interesting transition, and I am very keen to understand it and how that happened, and all the way through to kind of Stanford and Y Combinator. So we've got a bit to kind of dive through. Rachel, thank you so much for your time. I'm really interested and excited for the conversation.
Thanks for having me, Nigel. And I love how you've picked out these little mysteries that you plan to solve while we're here.
We will solve them bit by bit and hopefully piece them together and kind of build a picture of yourself, of GeoSight, and of kind of maybe the impact that you guys are looking to have on the insurance sector and more broadly, I think, in terms of thinking about geospatial data as a sector, I guess. Maybe that's a nice place to start, which is founding story. I think it's really interesting sometimes to kind of frame it up and understand kind of how you got to where you are, where the inspiration came from. And maybe we can start there in terms of that founding and inspiration, and we can kind of leave from there. Over to you.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting story. Feel free to jump anytime. It has some twists and turns, right? Mm. So like you mentioned in the intro, I actually started in mechanical engineering, specializing in manufacturing. So I always like to tell people that because when you think about my company or our vision or our impact on insurance and the things that drive us, and I think the things that, you know, really tie together the culture of our company, a lot of it stems from this deep, deep love of operational accuracy and clarity. So if you think about factories, there is nowhere more immediately measurable where you can say, this is working, this is not. Let's titrate here, let's titrate there, right? And when I started to develop an understanding of the geospatial industry, this was really back, you know, 2015, 2016, as part of a giant study I was doing for the Air Force, I was piecing together that there was all this incredible data, right? You mentioned a bunch at the top, satellite imagery, drone imagery, IoT data, tons of geospatial analytics. Like if you picture 2016, people were just getting very excited about geospatial AI, right? And we can go into some of the places where it's working and the places where it's not later, but there was a lot of excitement over industrial IoT, geospatial AI, Internet of Things for commercial set or, you know, for residential settings, things like that. And then all of the new climate data that was also becoming available as, you know, more and more folks have been attracted to that industry and better business models and actual climate models have been developed, just this massive slew of data. So if you think about the manufacturing world, you're used to measuring and using that data, but a lot of other industries didn't know how to use geospatial data. So I became obsessed with this problem of how do you take all of this extraordinary and rich data about what's happening all over the planet, you know, both with the built world and also with the climate and weather patterns and, you know, information on the ground, how do you take all of that and allow it to actually impact operations? What is that mechanism? And, you know, I spent many years before I even started GeoSight just studying that problem, completely obsessed with it. So bit of an academic on that. I find a problem and I'm like, this is a crazy one.
And how did that transition then go in terms of, obviously you went deep, like really deep in the problem, understood the problem set. I imagine often the link is having that depth of knowledge and then seeing the application opportunity. And so kind of interested in how you kind of came across that application opportunity.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. I always tell people I was a reluctant entrepreneur. I didn't set out to start a company. I was perfectly happy working on my PhD and doing mechanical engineering. And I saw this market problem. And it was really what you're talking about, that application and actual real world impact of the problem that I was seeing at the market level on people's lives that caused me to start the company. So back when I was doing my PhD, I was spending a lot of time working with the Department of Defense, all over the Department of Defense, and including our special operations teams. And U.S. special operations teams were facing the same problem insurance companies are today. So I always like to tell our customers, like, don't worry, Navy SEALs have this problem too. And then that makes them feel happy about geospatial data. But the absolute explosion in commercially available geospatial data, you know, has been really recent, really just the last couple decades. And so the trailing factor behind that is the software and the data platforms and the ability to process and ingest that data. Mm-hmm. And a unit that I was working with, we were doing a root cause analysis on casualties that they had had, and several of those had arisen from lack of data. And the really interesting thing as we dug into it is that it wasn't that the data didn't exist. The data did exist. There was imagery, there was information about, you know, what was going to be on the ground. But the problem was all the plumbing for that data. And so it was the exact same market problem that I had been seeing before, but in a very acute setting, where if they had been able to understand the availability of all of these different sources of data, and then actually, you know, get just what they needed, not have to filter through all of it, that data would have been actionable. And so literally it kept me up at night after that. And so I ended up starting the company because I was like, this is such an important problem to work on. And that really kicked it off. I had no idea that we'd end up in insurance. I've ended up loving it. It's great.
Yeah. And that's that kind of, that's an interesting transition. Yeah. But I think, kind of users of data, I suppose, I guess when you're thinking about who are the actors commercially who use a bunch of data to kind of help drive decision making, and obviously kind of government and defense seems like a very kind of powerful place to start. But obviously, yep, the insurance sector from a commercial perspective outside of kind of the public sector obviously is probably one of the largest users of that type of data. So is it kind of a seamless transition for you to go, like, we're kind of doing a bunch of work in government and we need to look in the commercial sector, and therefore insurance kind of feels like it's the right place to play? Or did you have kind of inbound approaches? How did you make that kind of leap into the insurance sector?
Yeah, so it's really a two-part There are two things that came together to lead to us being in insurance. The first is when we launched the company, because I had so much experience working with the Department of Defense, I knew that we could get a ton of research and development dollars from the Air Force, mm-hmm, to build out our data platform, right? So geospatial data is extraordinarily complex and heavy. And especially if you're trying to do all the homework of, you know, assessing and combining satellite imagery from different sources, drone imagery from different sources, aerial imagery from different sources, analytics from different sources. So being able to say, are we all looking at the same thing? That's very hard from both a programmatic and a technology standpoint. And so I knew that it would take us time to develop this platform before it would be commercially ready. So we really just started on the government side. At this point, really our biggest government work is search and rescue. So search and rescue across the United States is actually run on our platform. And that's work that's very important to us. They save 370 lives a year, which is just mind-boggling.
Amazing. Yeah.
And we knew we'd have to search for the commercial application, mm-hmm, right? Because again, geospatial was not my home industry. I understand sensors, I understand engineering, I understand systems design, I understand bureaucracies, right, from working with government, but I didn't necessarily come from an industry that needed to use the data. And so we knew we had our homework cut out for us. We explored a bunch of different industries. Insurance was one of those industries on that list. And really the tipping point came because in the very earliest days of GeoSite, long before we were considering insurance, MS&AD Ventures put a check into GeoSite when we were going through Y Combinator. So they, you know, came up to me and they were like, you have to get into insurance. And I was like, okay, we're very busy doing all of our government stuff. We're working in, you know, we were doing some stuff in energy and remote operations there. I was like, maybe we'll get around to insurance. And then, you know, as the industry really started to pick up, we collaborate a lot with AWS and other major partners to say, who is actually storing and using the most geospatial data, right? And which industries do we want to tackle together? So we use this insight from these partners to figure out, okay, is this a one-off that MS&AD is really excited, or is it actually the entire industry? And it really was the entire industry. And so starting last year, we decided our entire commercial strategy would be bet on insurance.
And which is a big bet, but a massive industry and a lot of money is spent, and a lot of money is spent trying to understand and how valuable this is on the underwriting piece, I think is obviously the most critical area, right? And from a founder's perspective, I'm interested, just a slight deviation left of Y Combinator. Like, how did you find it? How was the experience? Was it an easy pitch in? Like, how did you find it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm here in the Bay Area, right? So now they're much more global. But back when we went through it in 2019, it was pre-COVID, right? So it was primarily, you were only allowed into the program if you came here to the Bay Area. So there was definitely a higher density of teams from here. And I, you know, went to Stanford. So it's just kind of, you know, I always joke they just peer pressure you into starting a company. If you can go there and not even ever want to be an entrepreneur, and you'll get bullied into it.
By someone, a friend, a colleague.
By someone. Oh, yeah. A professor. Yeah. I mean, all of them.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurship just like runs deep here. And so YC is obviously well known. If you are in the Bay Area and in tech in any regard. And so I knew about Y Combinator. I founded the company on my own. So I was a solo founder. On top of that, solo female founder in a hard tech industry, right? So talk about stacking all the hard things for raising venture capital. And so I have a fantastic group of like female founder CEO friends. And this is always my biggest advice to any founder. Find other CEOs that are going to have a similar experience or have had a similar experience to what you will have. Find peers, not just peers in technology, but the whole thing. So that way then you can rely on each other. And it was a recommendation from a friend of like, should you YC, it'll really help you get your first round secured. So it won't be such an uphill battle. She was dead on. It was super helpful. So, you know, the pitch is hard. It really helped that I was walking in saying, I have 1.4 million in R&D money from the Air Force. And it's me, a PowerPoint, and my CTO starts in 2 weeks, you know? And they were like, yeah, that seems, sure. we'll take a bet on that. Yeah, exactly. So that definitely helped, right? So I think the bar keeps getting risen for these accelerators where now they expect you to actually already have revenue of one sort or another before you even start.
Yeah. You kind of talked there about your kind of CTO starting kind of after you've maybe got that first R&D check, and that maybe kind of opens the door a little bit to the technology layer. And you spoke a little earlier on around the complexities of different structured data, bringing those different structures of data into a single place and then making it accessible and usable by kind of your customers. And that sounds very simple at the top, but I have absolutely no doubt underneath is an incredibly complex task to do. So can you give us a little bit of a sense of that? We don't want to go too technical, but give a sense of kind of how you think about data sources you work with, then how you think about kind of putting those plumbing pieces together, and then maybe then how you then expose that on the user level in terms of via API or kind of however you then deliver that to your customers.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. As you were talking, I was debating how to explain it. There's the fun way to me, which is hyper technical, and I think we'll lose people after about 30 seconds, or kind of story based. Yep, so we'll go a little bit more story based. We'll stick with Hurricane Ian, because that's one that all of your listeners are very familiar with. So during Hurricane Ian, if you imagine, you know, we're gonna stick with claims and Nat Cat response for a second, and then we can dive into underwriting after that. But I think underwriting is more straightforward. But if you look at heading into a disaster, there's a bunch of activities that need to happen. You have teams starting to estimate reserving, starting to, you know, try to say, this is an event. How are we going to do those? Which reinsurance are we going to activate? Do we need more reinsurance? Can we get it? You know, there's tons of activities around the reserving aspect. And then there's a second set of activities happening around, do we have the personnel in place and the procedures in place for the number of claims that we're expecting. Are we expecting a high number, a low number? You know, how much of our portfolio is going to be affected, et cetera. So there's this flurry of activities, which really have to do with operational efficiency and then financial efficiency on the reserving side. With both of those, where this becomes really interesting from a geospatial perspective is it's not just accuracy and timing matter for so many of these things. How quickly and how accurately can you get an answer when you need to make a decision? And so the speed part is most insurers cannot validate, go through a GSA process and procure geospatial data in less than 3 months, right? Realistically, we're talking about 6 months. If you're having to go through a new procurement, a new relationship, all of that, all of those negotiations. So just from a, is the right data available? Do we have it for this specific disaster? That part is very hard in terms of speed. With accuracy, one of the things that we didn't anticipate when we got into insurance is how few carriers and reinsurers actually have a hyper-accurate view of where their policies are, which seems like the most basic, foundational thing that we just expected, right? Mm-hmm. We were like, great, you give us your locations, we're going to layer all this amazing flood data and wind data, and you know, all of these we can run all of these amazing analytics, and we have, you know, dozens of partners, so we can validate that data, we can look for outliers, you know, whatever, all this stuff. But if you don't know where the building is, none of it matters. So there's something called geocoding, which when you use Uber and you type in an address and it drops a pin on a map, that's geocoding, right? It goes from a string of text that is an address to a lat long. A lot of times that pin is not dropping on the building, right? That pin is dropping on the road or near the building. Sometimes you have to drag the map and put it where you are. What you're doing is you're manually fixing the geocoding in that process. The issue with that is even that lat long doesn't really give you the building, right? It's just
a perimeter and all of those kind of pieces.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. And so if you think about the accuracy, absolutely extraordinary accuracy of these new peril models and new property characteristic models, those are amazing if you know what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times that property analytics models aren't correct or flooding estimates aren't correct, it's not because the data was off. It's because the actual location that was analyzed is wrong. And so when it came to Hurricane Ian, if you're looking at 250,000 properties and all of those are, you know, you're using a geocoder that biases towards the road and the road is, it tends to be lower than where you put buildings, your entire estimation is completely skewed. So that's where you see these carriers, you know, go through their reserving process and say, this is going to be a $80 million disaster. And then it turns out to be a $20 million disaster. Or vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times it comes down to the inability to use geospatial data in its geospatial form. They simplify everything down to a lat long, and then they assess it from there, and it's all wrong.
Mm. Interesting. And like when you think about the actual underlying technology, obviously you've done a bunch of it. Like you've from a kind of AI machine learning perspective, like obviously there's been an explosion of kind of LLMs over the last kind of 6-8 months, and you look at every company that's being funded today, if you don't have AI or ML in the deck, you won't
not
get
just
money.
AI, now you have to have generative AI.
Generative AI, true that. So you guys obviously been in this world a little bit longer than the last 6 months. And I know obviously this world's been building for a while. Like how are you, what's your general view of kind of how you kind of use those technologies today? Have you got a general view of how you're going to continue to use them over time?
Yeah, I think there's going to be, everybody's so excited about ChatGPT, myself included. It's so fun. And I hope everybody's using it to do things like meal planning. It's so good at offloading like stuff that takes time that you don't want to do. It's great. But the way that we've looked at it is there's two steps to analysis of geospatial data. So there's the first step, which we have tons of partners for. So that's basically taking an image and extracting information from it, taking satellite imagery, drone imagery, or whatever kind of data you want, saying it's this kind of roof, it has this condition, this many tree, this percent tree overhang, et cetera, right? So that's kind of first layer analytics in the world of geospatial. The second layer is the layer where really we play in, which is if you imagine the world's best GIS analyst. So I always joke that we're just trying to replicate Sarah, who leads our data science team. She knows so many data sources just off the top of her head, so many technologies, so many different ways they can be applied, and she can really cleverly apply different data sets in different ways to different problems really quickly, right? And so when we think about AI, it's not usually doing things humans can't. It's doing things at a scale that humans can't for the cost that you want to use them, right? And so the layer of AI where we play, and really we just call it our recommendation engine, because a lot of times AI is just fancy statistics, honestly. We play in the, can you create the world's best spatial analyst in a box, right? So I, as an insurance company, can say, I would like to underwrite this property. What should I worry about? We can say, well, you know, the roof is in great condition, actually. The, you know, POI data shows it's rented out to this company, which has this, you know, Dun & Bradstreet, you know, rating and, you know, whatever, all this information. But you know what? You should flag that it's right next to a laundromat because, you know, this laundromat has lots of chemicals. So actually, even though this property is not, you know, that dangerous, here are the spatial risks that you should be worried about. Here's the actual flood inundation chance. The building's actually lifted 4 feet off the ground, more so than the other ones. So you don't actually need to worry about flooding, but you do need to worry about this, right? So the ability to give really complex answers on risk from lots of different data sources. So we're constantly adding new data sources and constantly working on that so that we have this model that's continuously saying, for this building, for this geography, for these peril coverages, here are the best data sources. And let's put that automatically into your workflow so you don't have to think about it.
Love it. And how do you think that projects forward? It's like if you were to take kind of maybe not just kind of geosite, but geospatial data as an industry, like how do you think that in terms of speed of acceleration, I suppose, from the last 5 years, it feels kind of exponentially, like it feels like very fast, more and more use of information. How does 5, 10, 15 years look like for you kind of within geospatial?
So it's a really interesting question because it actually plays into the entire premise of why I started the company. So I hate this word because it's such a buzzword, but it's the most succinct way of putting it, is by having a geospatial data platform, we're future-proofing those sources for this reason. I think the biggest changes in the next 15 years will be a heavier reliance on long flight, high altitude, fixed wing drones for imagery over satellites. Like I think that the fundamental platforms that we use for data collection will change to be more automated. You can imagine a world where there's a flood that's going to happen in southern Australia. They've had absolutely historic flooding in the last year. There's a flood that's going to happen. You have a weather alert that alerts a tasking, you know, sort of algorithm, which is something we're striving towards, that says, hey, is the best asset for this a satellite, a drone, et cetera? And it can launch and task those sorts of platforms to collect that data. The analysis is run. Immediately, you're getting those answers. So I think when I look at 15 years from now, I think the biggest change for the insurance industry that will be driven by geospatial data is having better answers automatically. That's the goal. Right? So you can say, hey, there's this big weather event and there's already sitting in your inbox or on your dashboard. Here's the expected level of damage from this event. Rather than, you know, right now there's a lot of guesswork and intuition that drives that process and less data.
That's so interesting. It maps kind of very closely to what you mentioned earlier on around kind of almost like timing and localization of that data. I.e. kind of something's going to happen. We need to find a way to get that data into our system to do all the work that we need to do. And therefore, kind of how can we have that on a almost an on-demand basis, I suppose, versus kind of an always-on basis. And that's super interesting insight.
Yeah. I mean, I love this industry. I think it's going to continue getting cooler and cooler. Eventually, it'll be like Mission Impossible meets insurance, you know? I think it'll be nice.
How have you found the insurance world that you're in today compared to the maybe government and kind of public sector world that you I suppose originated from? I think there's I came from outside the industry too, and I think that you get a lot of folks say that things can take a bunch of time, but actually I think on the flip side, I think there's a huge drive to do things differently and improve. And so that's kind of what we see. Have you felt the same? Like, obviously you've been in two kind of sectors that are reasonably heavily regulated, kind of generally kind of earmarked as slow moving, but how have you found it?
Yeah, I always joke I'm an expert in bureaucracy. Actually, so even though my PhD was technically mechanical engineering, my dissertation, which still has one chapter to be written, so I'm not doctor yet, was written about innovation in necessarily bureaucratic and hierarchical organizations. That's what I ended up actually doing my research on, was how do you take massive organizations and allow them to inject new technology? From the process standpoint, that stuff doesn't faze me. I think at the end of the day, people hate bureaucracy, but really what they are, you know, reacting to is usually outdated or inefficient internal policy, right? And so bureaucracy is necessary for a very large organization to exist that people need to rely on, right? There's a reason why there's so much policy in place and so many rules and insurance, and they're not all bad, right? Some of them slow us down, but they're not all bad. And so that aspect is the same. I would say the biggest difference is when you work in the public sector in any way, this is true of something as ambiguous as national security, right? And I call it ambiguous, but that's kind of, I'm joking. I have like probably 40 books on my bookshelf that are all defining different kinds of national security and defense. There's a gazillion definitions of it, which means there's no one version of it. So when you look at, you know, the national defense strategy or the ways that people are saying, this is why we exist and this is what these are the problems we're going to solve, you know, et cetera. There's a lot of subjective interpretation of, okay, here's commander's intent, and now we have this thing we're going to go do, but we don't know exactly how we're going to do it. And so things can get a little bit squishy and a little bit hard to nail down what is it that we're trying to do, especially when you look forward 5 years, 10 years, et cetera, with how fast technology is moving. So I think defining kind of the baseline problem is always tougher on the government side. I have loved insurance because it's just math. It's a bunch of math, which I know for most people that may not be their cup of tea, but it was hard instilled in me by my engineer mother that we love math, right? Mm-hmm. And graphs and all these things. And there's a beauty to insurance that it is a financially driven industry where it is hyper measurable, the impact that you're having. And there's pretty good alignment of incentives between insurance companies, the carriers, and their customers a lot of the time, right? Like they actually truly want to have good customer success, right? Because their customer acquisition cost to lifetime value is such a tough equation. They actually want to do right by their customers. And that's amazing. So we have all these conversations with carriers about, okay, how can we make living through a natural disaster a better experience? Like, what can we do to help these people? Can we pay them out sooner? Can we give everybody who we think will be affected a, you know, first tranche of their claim while we await more data? Are there ways that we can do this better? And so there's these really wild and wonderful impacts that the insurance world has. And the second piece is, I think it's the only industry that I've found so far, so I'd love if somebody else could find one for me, where there is an actual measurable financial advantage to working on climate change and paying attention to it and measuring it, and not just out of, you know, wanting to live in a wonderful world, but actual like fiscal responsibility that can be tied pretty closely to, do we know what the frequency and severity of natural catastrophes is going to be over the next 10 years, 30 years? So I get really excited. I think it's an important mission with a much crisper measurability than a lot of the government work that we did. At the same time, getting to be involved, you know, getting our software used for 11,000 search and rescue incidents a year, including 370 that are life-saving operations. That's pretty inspiring too. So they're both pretty great. But I think I spend a lot of time convincing people insurance is cool, whereas I don't have to convince them that search and rescue is cool.
Search and rescue is cool. Yeah, very true. And if you were to think of how, like, Spain to a bunch of carriers, like obviously Lyft to the pod, and I know their minds will be exploding right now. If you were to think about how you like to interface with your carrier customers in terms of maybe from a technology perspective, I know that it can often be said that maybe there's a, often the attitudes there, but maybe in the technology and capability maybe kind of slow is a little bit behind that. So how have you kind of faced that battle, and how have you kind of got over that battle when you work with your carrier customers?
Yeah, I have a really great analogy. So if you imagine that a insurance carrier is like an aircraft carrier, right? Very big ship, very hard to turn, right? They have a lot of inertia behind them. And you're in a little pirate ship, and you would like to put something into process on this big ship. One thing you definitely can't do is sail perpendicular to them, right? They're going to keep cruising past. You're not slowing them down. You're not changing their direction. You're not going to have an impact. Instead, what you have to do is you have to find the point at which you can meet their current velocity, right? Where is there a spot where we can engage right now and make an immediate impact in their current process, right? So there's a lot of digital transformation, massive, massive projects going on across the insurance industry, which is great. And those are mostly 5 and 10 year projects, as they honestly, frustratingly, sometimes need to be, right? And I know not everybody likes that answer, but it's, if you are thinking about a massive organization, you can't change it that fast. Like, you need more stability than that. So if you're a startup, you can't expect to change the direction of the aircraft carrier. You're not going to do it, right? And even if you're not a startup, you're just a new technology provider, even from a big company, you're not going to do that. And so when we engage with the carriers that we've worked with, we either pick claims and reserving for post-catastrophe, or underwriting and providing better access to data sources for projects that they've already decided to do, right? So finding these entry points where the carrier already knows what needs to be done. They already have a process that they're working on. And what you're doing is just injecting better answers, mm-hmm. saying, okay, we have an API, you know, that API stays stable, right, over time, even though the satellite providers might change, the analytics providers might change, the geocoders might change. As there's new technology, we're going to constantly add it to our platform and that recommendation engine. But you have something stable that you can rely on that will have all these variables that you will need for claims, for reserving, for underwriting, for customer success, right? And so for us, it's about giving them a stable point while the rest of the world is changing really fast. And that's how we've found is a great engagement. Of course, we also have a very shiny web app that can show you all of this extraordinary data, right? You can see aerial imagery from GIC and flood inundation from a bunch of different partners and property analytic data from a bunch of different partners. And you can see all of that and use it. But most of the time, we really just want to put that data directly into their process. So that way then they don't have an additional platform they're having to deal with.
Yeah, totally. And that makes sense. And actually something we skipped over a little bit earlier on today. We obviously used, but we have reasonably deep in the kind of claims and that cap, but we didn't dip into that underwriting piece. And I think that's an area that I suppose is maybe more linear and understandable, like quickly for a carrier. And
yeah, absolutely.
To be usable. Can you give us a sense of that in terms of maybe a use case that you guys are working with today of how it's impacting some underwriting data?
Yeah. So I'll give the example of property characteristics and cat risk, right? One of the perennial problems with cat risk in insurance is that most carriers rely on only a couple models. And what that creates is systemic risk across their portfolio. So if when you're assessing, let's stick with commercial P&C sort of insurance, if you're assessing a really high-end commercial property with a high dollar amount policy, you're going to want to know that you've done your homework on what the risks are to that property. And if you have a bunch of them, right? You can think about risk accumulation, all those things. If you're using a single model for all of that, rather than different models that might have differing accuracy for different geographies, you start to create a risk because you're betting on a single model. So in the underwriting world, there's a couple pieces to this. One is, you know, access to data that, you know, you may not have now. But the other piece of it is, hey, you know, we have all the information from the last flood or last hurricane or last fire in this area. Here are how all the models performed. Which model should we be using going forward in underwriting? So it's really about having a continuous feedback loop of those data sources within your underwriting process. One place where we've seen this realized is we partnered with Socotra. And inside of Socotra's underwriting tool, you can put GeoSight behind it and you can be underwriting a policy, you put in the address, you hit autofill. What it does is it hits our platform. Our platform says, okay, here's this address. Now we get to deal with the geocoding problem. Do we actually know where the building is? Can we find the building? Not just the lot long, the building. Great. We found the building. Let's send that exact polygon into the property characteristic algorithms, right? That way then we know we're all looking at the same thing. And let's send that footprint into the different flood models, into the different fire models. Let's do proximity calculations of that exact building to the waterfront or to whatever, right? So you get just much more accurate information in a more automated fashion. And so that's where I was talking about earlier of you don't want to try to turn the massive ship. Instead, you can say, what are the attributes that you're using now? And where are you finding that you don't have high enough accuracy or reliability in your data sources for those attributes? And can we get you those through our dozens of partners?
Absolutely love it. And I just want to talk a little bit now about the future and maybe the first of all, the future of the future of GeoSight, and then maybe the future of the insurance industry. Obviously, with the pod being the future insurer, this is kind of, I guess, our thinking of how can we pull all the smartest people
together. That's the work. Now that we've had all the fun, we have to do the work, right?
We have to do the work.
The
future.
Right.
We
have to. Yeah.
We have to talk about the future. Where do we want to take it to? and so maybe you started GeoSight like 15 years. Like, where would, like, what's your aspiration? Like, where do you kind of wake up every morning and think this is where I'd love the company to be?
I would be extremely excited if when people think about, I need better situational awareness for any reason, right? We've built our platform to be industry agnostic. So not just insurance, right? Or special operations or search and rescue, but also agriculture, you know, logistics, you know, you name it. That we can be a relied upon source for data. Right. And I think when I say reliable and like relied upon, there's a bunch of different pieces to that. And this is really what excites me. And I think it is a core value of our company is we want to give people the best data. So we built our business model around platform access, not charging for data. And the reason we did that is there's an extraordinary amount of cool data out there. Some of it's open source. Some of the most accurate models we found are open source. There's open source climate data, but then there's also extremely exquisite, very expensive climate data or imagery or these things, right? And so there's this world of data out there. And my vision is that when someone uses the GeoSight platform, they know they are getting the absolute best data for their problem set. And best isn't always most accurate or most timely. It also includes things like cost and appropriateness to the problem that you're trying to solve and all of those things. And that our system will be applying data in a way that possibly is even more clever than, you know, the extraordinary geospatial analyst, because it has had these feedback loops to learn, hey, last time in Houston, we used this model. That model has these assumptions. Going forward, there's this other model that has different assumptions, which better match reality, right? And so it can actually understand the nuance of all the data in order to give you that best answer.
I absolutely love it. And how does that map? I know you've spoken there about insurance isn't the only sector you want to play in, which I completely respect. But if you are thinking about the insurers that you work with today, those carriers, those aircraft carriers, and you were to think about like what the C-suite of those companies are thinking about, and thinking where their companies will be in the next kind of 10, 20, 30 years, kind of, but what do you think they will look like? Do you think they'll look the same? Do you think they'll look slightly different? Kind of interested in your view.
Yeah. You know, 15 years isn't a long time in the insurance industry. So let's say 25. Mm-hmm. In 25 years, what I'll be really excited about, and I think we're heading there, right? Because people are starting to talk about it, is much more dynamic understanding of risk, which means much more dynamic products from the insurance industry. So instead of having a pre-baked product that has specific factors, you know, that are considered for that product, you can have a really customized product that targets that exact customer, right? There are certain things that, you know, for instance, our company's key person insurance, right? There are ways in which I am totally not a risk. There are other ways which I totally am, right? Mm-hmm. And I am a very, you know, unique person. I like, you know, off-roading, or, you know, recently learned spearfishing, right? Like, but at the same time, I'm not much of a risk for a lot of other things. And so you can, if you can get into the nuance of what risks are we actually making a promise to the consumer for, let's have them pay for the risks that they care about, and maybe some that are compulsory. And then let's not worry about the rest, right? Like, let's make sure that we have exactly what we need. And so I think that the world 25 years from now will just look much more dynamic. And it may also be that, you know, you sign on to a policy that says, hey, if you're consistently driving more than 20% over the speed limit, your rate is going to go up, right? And we're already seeing some of those sort of dynamic things, especially using telematics in car insurance. But you could imagine that for homes and especially commercial properties as well.
Rachel, I absolutely love it. Thank you so much. Today has been incredibly insightful. I have learned an enormous amount. I'm sure everybody else listening has too. And the business and what you're trying to do is a massive inspiration. I think they're going to do incredibly well. Keep doing what you're doing. Thank you so much for your time. And I wish you all the best for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Have a great week, Nigel.
Thanks, Rachel.